Okay, so the Rosh Hashanah was due, services were due that night. The building was ready, as much as be ready, and the contractor, Philip Cohen, God bless him, was working up to the last minute building the Oren Kodesh. He had just got done making a little privy outside where people could go to the bathroom, but we had to have an Oren Kodesh, because we had a Torah, but no place to put the Torah. So here he was nailing up until the very last minute. And his son lived just around the corner, so he had time to go up there and get a bath and get dressed and come down to shul. And when he was putting in the nail, the last nail in that box for an Oren Kodesh, the first people were walking down already dressed up real nice for Rosh Hashanah. And we had services. My brother Bill was the cantor, and he fancied himself as he at one time wanted to go in to be a cantor, and he has a nice voice, and he knew the nigun very well. So he sang. He was the rabbi, the cantor. I think we did have a rabbi. Yes, we did. Rabbi Gross, and the place was packed. The next morning was one of the hottest days of the year, and there must have been no shuls in Pittsburgh in those years were air conditioned, except maybe Rodef Shalom. And everybody must have been having a terrible sweltering day, but not Parkway Jewish Center. We had a breeze coming through those open doors and windows, because there was no doors or windows, and it was just a machaya, unbelievable. But when it came to Yom Kippur, it was already cold. But their people were packed so tight that they were warm. But for Yom Kippur night, remember, we had pigtail sockets and the rented chair. No chairs, just benches. And people were sitting. And there were so many people that you couldn't move. There was no room for anything else. So people were standing around the outside in the back, and it was wet. And in the darkness, in the back, one of the people standing in the back who came to hear the Yom Kippur was Jackie Heller. He was performing at the Holiday House, and it was Yom Kippur. And he's very Jewish, and he couldn't help. He heard there's a shul here, so he came to the shul. And I didn't know it until later. I looked around. And there's Jackie Heller.
Oh, he didn't have his downtown nightclub at that time?
No, he was performing at that was after, that was gone already, I think. I don't remember. Anyway, there he was. And so we had this building, and we used it, and then how much, it was just like a 20 by 50. That's how big the whole thing was, 20 by 50. That's a big garage. And that was our shul and our cheder and everything for a year and a half. And Rabbi Gross got busy and raised more money, and we built up another section, and then after that another section. And each time we had big hoopla, we had Governor Lawrence came to be the ribbon cutter. And we had some very big people. Ben Paul Brazley heard about us and gave us $1,000 right off the bat. And we had some very good help from community. Rabbi Gross was able to bring this money in. And so the building was built. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a gem of a building, beautiful building. If you want to go up after we're through, I'll show it to you.
Where is it located?
It's in about a mile, half a mile from here. And I have a key. I was the original president. I'm an honorary president now. I was president for a long time and been very active, and it's my baby, and I feel I've accomplished a very good thing, because from this congregation came at least two dozen very, very Orthodox Jews, young people who are capable of conducting services anywhere, anytime, who are capable of starting a congregation wherever they are, who are capable of leading, being a Baal Kriya, many of them, and a Baal Musaf, and thoroughly Jewish, observant Jews. That's a small fraction of all the total number that came out of the 160 or 200 or 300 families which came and went and are still here, some of them.
How many members do you have
160
today?
Members now.
Families or members?
Family. families. Mm-hmm. Families. And, well, family is a member plus the wife. We don't count the additional, just the families. And we're conservative, officially belong to conservative. And we have a delightful service every Saturday with a dozen people or so. One of the people who comes is Mrs. Merenstein and Dr. Ganuni. He and his whole family comes. Very much love the service. But of course, the people who don't come except 3 days a year, they never did. I don't worry about, think about them. I worry about them. But anyway, my mission was accomplished in that I stemmed. Not one person ever used a Christmas tree anymore after I started that. I never saw that anymore. And I really stopped one generation from quickly becoming assimilated. And we attracted people who were intensely Jewish, and they stayed here for 10, 15 years, and then they went on. But during that time, we had a very thriving, observant community, and I really feel good having brought that and fostered it. I don't know how much longer that's going to go on, but at least for 30 years, I've kept my finger in the dike to keep that flood from assimilating a lot more than would have been assimilated. Mm-hmm. And some of them were turned on by our milieu, by our people. And some of them became very religious here and moved to Squirrel Hill and are still, and the Lubavitcher people. So when I think about three generations from now, and that's where my focus is, I don't worry about us. Three generations is what I'm thinking about. I can't think beyond that. I believe I've accomplished a great deal for that generation, that they'll still be Jewish and not kissing. They'll be kissing tzitzis and not beads. Mm-hmm. So you asked about my family. Okay, when I was in here, and my son Elliot was growing up, I wanted him to get a Jewish education, better than a cheder. So I took him to Hillel. When he was 3 years old, I started, and I took him to kindergarten. And Ellsworth, that's where they had the kindergarten then. And took him there and took him back every day. Then when he went...
You mean Ellsworth Avenue?
Ellsworth Avenue. Mm-hmm. They had an old house there, which was their kindergarten. And Elliot, when he was three and a half, walked in. He couldn't contain him. He was very, very active. So he walked into the office, and they let him there. And he looks over Mrs. Brog's shoulder while she's typing, and he's reading what she's writing. Three and a half. And she let him type. And he's typing. I didn't even know that. She told me about that. He's typing letters, words, mm-hmm. at age three and a half. Anyway, he goes to Hillel, and he's there for till the eighth grade, and I took him back and forth every day in all that time. Well, in the sixth or seventh grade, they finally got a bus. But up until that time, for many years, I came from Eastmont to Squirrel Hill to my office, back to Squirrel Hill and home every day, took him in my car. And that was going out of my way. And one of the people I used to pick up when I was left Hillel, and I was on my way downtown, and in the park, I once saw a guy with a bunch of books and hitchhiking, and I picked him up, and I look on the seat, and he's got two medical books and two lawyer books, law books. I said, forensic medicine. I looked up what I know about forensic medicine. That was...
Cyril Wecht.
Cyril Wecht, when he was going to Pitt in medical school. and legal school, studying both. And I picked him up 2 or 3 times. I happened to see him. That's my first experience with him. I got to love him very much. And then Elliot then came to high school here. We took him out. I don't know why. I don't know what it was, but we were afraid that they didn't have enough training for his mind, because he was near genius then. And he, well, not a genius, but he was real bright. And he made, did 800 on his SAT. In those years, you know, in 66 with math, it was terrific. So he went to high school here, and the high school happened to be very good, unusually good.
What is the name of the high school?
It used to be called Churchill High School. And all his peers were brilliant, absolutely brilliant. It was an unusual class. These are the children of the officials from the Westinghouses and other places. Anyway, he sort of lost his orthodoxy. Was not, and just like my mother never told me what to do, I never told him what to do. And I was not a Shomer Shabbos, and maybe that's the reason that he didn't become. Then he went on to MIT, and from MIT went to Boston University, and he got a degree at MIT, and he entered into a PhD program in computer science and in math. They're interchange. And then he did that at Boston University. Then he got interested in, he kept asking for money, and I thought he was on drugs, and I was really worried about him. But it turns out that he was turned on with Lubavitch, and he was buying books like mad. You know, the library is unbelievable, and he couldn't get enough of it. He got so interested that one day at night he studied and studied and studied and didn't know until the sun shined in his face that it was morning. That kind of a total sponge up all that stuff. And he was in it so deep that he didn't have the, he already passed his coursework to have a PhD in computer science or math. You know what that meant? He couldn't stay with it. The Torah was just overwhelming. So he stayed in, I'll go backwards. We belonged to the Ridgemont Swimming Club. I was a charter member. And one of the people who were members there were the Ehrenriches. And Elliot was 16 years old, and this Ehrenrich girl was 16. He was madly in love with her. Oh, he really loved her. But she went off and married somebody else, Jason Cutler, and he was heartbroken. One day when Elliot was in Boston, and at Boston University, he gets a phone call from Jason. Elliot, hey, how you doing? How's Linda? I guess she's all right. We're divorced. Why don't you call her up? So he called her up and went to visit with her in Rochester, New York, because she had a house. She bought a house on her own, and she had a little 5-year-old daughter. So she came to visit Elliot with her daughter and her brother, and they stayed in the hotel. And Elliot took them to see his world, the young people that he lived with. She was just overwhelmed. She was so affected by it that she couldn't wait to go home and sell her house and buy another house close to equivalent of a hill house so her 5-year-old daughter could go to school there. Because she was a school teacher. She has a master's degree in speech therapy and she special education. And she saw what kind of a jungle these kids are, and her daughter would have to be part of the crowd. And she saw how Elliot's kids were. So she made a quick change. And then Elliot was able to get a job in Rochester at Xerox. in which they work could continue to work on his PhD program while he was going to a yeshiva there. That's really where he wanted to go. The same Chofetz Chaim had a branch over there. So he ate that up real good and he stayed there. But he didn't stay for his PhD. By that time he decided to go on further. He couldn't go any further there, so he came to the main place in Forest Hills, in Kew Gardens. So he had been visiting her, and the little girl, she was now 6 years old, said, "Why don't you two get married?" So they did. It was a nice wedding. There's the picture of the wedding. That's the girl. You see them on the edge?
Yeah, lovely.
So they have three. She had this daughter. Saraleva is the daughter. And she's not here. Anyway, two children. This is his first daughter, Fady. And this is David Feigl. And then the newest one isn't on here, and he's Israel Mayer. They live an intensely Jewish life, but they're not Lubavitchers. They are in a sect, and it's not a sect. The Chofetz Chaim is the most erudite of the religious groups. They don't believe in tzitzis hanging out except in shul, and they don't wear special hats, and they don't wear a strimal, and they don't wear white socks. They look like anybody else, but they're very cerebral, and that's the element that he enjoys, and that's what he likes. And
now, where is this that they
are? And this is
now
in Kew Gardens, and that's where
Kew Gardens
is now.
New York.
New York, mm-hmm. Queens.
Yes.
And they live in a community of all people like that, and he's very happy. But a strange thing happened. I sold my business, exterminating business, to a company, just the exterminating service end of it. And I made a settlement in which for 5 years, so much a month would go to Elliot as a consultant, and so much would go to me. And the 5 years is up this month. And just in time, because I just sold my business now. This is for other reasons. And now he gets a continuation of payments, also as a consultant, because he's able to consult on computer, mm-hmm. which he does.
Yes.
It's not entirely paper. He actually does some work. And so he's able to live and go to school, and it's a 7-year program. And when he's through, he will have the highest kind of a smicha that's possible. It's a rare smicha. Donald Butler told me about it. I was not aware myself of what it meant. Elliot doesn't brag. He leaves that up to me. And this is very difficult to get. He would be qualified to be a head of a yeshiva. He would be one of these rabbis that other rabbis come to for advice on interpretation, that sort of thing. So this is a kind of a life he's living. The other boy that we had was 2 years younger than him, Fred. Fred was our pride and joy, tall, 6 foot, over 6 foot tall, handsome, athletic, very... a wonderful, straight. I wanted him to go into business with me, but he went in for biology at Northwestern, very good marks, good school, and never talked about anything he did. He'd go out swimming, he'd win the first prize, he'd go skiing, he'd win the first prize, never tell us anything, that sort of thing. And then I last thing I expected him to do was to go in for medicine. So he gets accepted at Hahnemann, very good school, and he's there for 3 years and doing real well, top of the class, and quiet. Everybody comes to him for the other students that had problems, the wife or husband or family or whatever, a social problem, other problems, psychological. He's always giving everybody advice. But nobody knew what was going on in him. He was a perfectionist of the worst kind. everything had to be absolutely perfect. Once the rabbi asked him if he would be a Baal Kriya. You know how hard it is to be a Baal Kriya? You know what a Baal Kriya is?
No, I don't.
That's taking the Torah, reading this without vowels, without any marks, without any sign, no periods, no nothing. You don't know anything. One letter after another continuous, and you have to read it and sing it in a particular way with special notes. I don't know how anybody knows this. It's that difficult. And he says, yeah, I'll do it. And he studied, and he made a half a dozen mistakes. Most of them make 50 mistakes. Nobody corrects them. That ate him up so much, he didn't want to go back to shul anymore. That's a perfectionist. So, and he was one of six that was picked to, he was a junior, but he had a letter in which he didn't tell us about it, in which he was picked to act as a finished medical doctor in charge of a floor of interns, of the new students, you know. He was just like, he had a medical degree and he was the intern in charge of that. And yet he hadn't graduated yet, they had six kids were picked for that job and he was one of the six. So he must have been a good student. The next thing we hear, that he jumped out of a high-story window and killed himself. And he's gone. From
how
one minute to another.
He, how old was he here?
That was 7 years ago. And Ruth never recovered. And that's the reason he had to go to Florida. And and when that happened, why, I had some money of my own. And I was executor of my aunt's estate. And so I got her money and other people's money. So $11,000 I donated in his name to Amchai, that's American Mental Health Aid to Israel, and they were just starting out, and they really needed some start, and that was what gave them a start. Now they're doing terrific in Israel, and they're helping immensely, and that came, so they're using the interest from our money to help them, so I accomplished a little bit of good with that, but that's small consolation. But he was our pride and joy. But there's nothing we can do about that. He was not on drugs. He was about ready to become a medical doctor, and I don't think that he could have faced. He was such a fanatically honest person that you know you can't be unless he was a researcher. Now I wish he went into research, but he couldn't go in for the shenanigans that a lot of medical people do, and he saw that's the world he had to be a part of, and he couldn't face it. And I didn't know it was that horrible of a feeling for him, such a crazy perfectionist. I'll show you some of the handiwork he did, a big sunburst that he made. I don't know where he learned these things. He had hands of gold. He could have done wonders as a surgeon. He was very meticulous and precise and neat and clean, and that was our Freddie.
And did you have other children?
Just those
two.
The
two sons. Harry, how would you contrast the way you were raised versus the way you raised your children?
Well,
in a similar fashion?
In the sense that I never told them what to do any more than my mother told me what to do, or my father, and lived by example. Mother was a holy woman, and by example, she did everything according to the book, fanatically honest. And that I wish maybe she was a little bit of a gunner, and I was a more of a gunner, Fred would be living. I'm sure of that. That came from Henoch. Henoch, who wouldn't take a drop of butter out of the milk.
What about the organizations within the community in which you lived? Aside from the synagogue, I'm sure you've been very active in other organizations here.
Well, I am a charter member of the American War Veterans, of the B'nai B'rith in our lodge here. But I'm just a member. I think I told you I'm a member of Hadassah Associate. Of course, my background in B'nai B'rith. I was lived and breathed it when I was in Canonsburg, secretary all the years from 29 until 35, or when I had to quit. And then in 36, I was secretary of the B'nai B'rith until I had to go in the Army, and then it disbanded. But I'm a director, and I was a director for many years in the ZOA locally, and but my membership in the Hebrew Free Loan, I'm a treasurer now. In a couple more years, I'll be president. 3 years, I'll be president, and that'll be the 100th birthday of the Hebrew Free Loan. I'm really proud of that organization. We help so many people, not just Jews, Gentiles, and blacks. Every night, two or three or four people we help, fantastic. Not a penny interest, nothing. Even if they're late, no penalty, nothing. And we're able to help them because so many people that Jews in 1900, 1905, that got their start with a $50 for a horse and then wound up a millionaire 50 years later, they left a bequest, and that interest from that money takes care of the small losses that we have. We don't have very many losses. We're really proud of them.
I understand you've lectured on entomology throughout the United States. Would you like to tell us about your involvement?
When I started in pest control, when I took over the business in 1946 from Fred Pollock, who was a friend of my father's, I think I've talked about him. I really didn't know a whole lot, but neither did anybody else, because this was a relatively new science. It was not even a science. There was no books at all written about it. One man in 1945, by the name of Arnold Malice, wrote a book, the first book that came out. I got a hold of that and I ate it up. And he came to Pittsburgh, the author of that book, in the early 50s. And I got acquainted with him, and we became lifelong friends. I would say he was my dearest friend. Actually, he just died this year. And I studied his book very well, and every problem that I had, I studied about it. So I learned on the job, and every piece of literature that I could get, I bought. I have one of the most extensive libraries on pest control in the United States. I had it in my office, and I just moved it up, and I'm just starting to get it collected. If you take one glance at through here, you'll see about one third. That's one third of my books.
That's quite a library.
And it's I've got entire volumes that go back. It's messy a little bit because I'm in the process of fixing that room up. And so I started to write. I was invited to write, and I for trade journals of industry, and one after another, and they kept building up. And now I write monthly columns. A column is called Myth Conception, and for the last 2.5 years, I have been writing every month a story which explodes a cherished notion of the industry. And I don't know where they keep coming, but they keep coming out. And so I'm getting quite a lot of calls from all over the country, even overseas, to speak on these subjects, and these are scientifically documented articles which debunks cherished notions of how to do things in pest control. So I get calls from overseas, from Venezuela, Puerto Rico, from all over the world, asking for questions about these things. So I'm now that I'm retired, which I just became retired last month, semi-retired, I'm going to spend more of my time writing and lecturing on pest control, new concepts, train people, and I like to do that. And I get calls to put on one-day seminars, one day, and I can talk on that subject. I'm associated with the Carnegie Museum. I'm a research associate there for about 10 years. I collect insects wherever I can in Florida, and I send them hundreds and hundreds of specimens, thousands, which they want and need. And I'm a member of the Pi Chi Omega, which is a distinguished fraternity of graduate entomologists who have been noteworthy in their field. And I'm an honorary member because I did not go to college. That it?
Not quite.
Oh,
we,
right,
we, we,